Donahue is the president of the International Court of Justice. She previously worked in the U.S. State Department. How do you think she will approach South Africa's application? What power does she have to shape the proceedings?
That's a good question, Juan. Yes, Donahue is a lifelong, career-long U.S. State Department legal apparatchik, which is how she got the job. And I'm sure she's in contact right now today with the U.S. State Department, giving them a heads up on everything going on over there at The Hague behind the scenes. She will toe the State Department party line in these proceedings. I regret to report the president does have a lot of power there to shape these proceedings. I suspect she will use that power to shape the proceedings in favor of Israel. However, I have also been advised that the Republic of South Africa is, as of now, nominating a judge ad hoc that is their right under the statute of the International Court of Justice. I don't have a name yet, but I would hope the South African judge ad hoc will do his or her best to try to keep Donahue straight.
I want to go back to South Africa, who has done this genocide filing. In 2008, I had the opportunity to speak with the South African anti-apartheid icon, the Nobel Peace Laureate, Archbishop Desmond Tutu. I caught up with him at the South African Vice Consul's apartment in New York right before Archbishop Tutu received the Global Citizens Circle Award. I asked him about Palestine.
Would you compare the occupation of Gaza and Gaza and the West Bank to apartheid South Africa?
I have to speak about what I know. I mean, most people, a Jew, will usually speak about their experiences and maybe compare whatever it is that is happening with what happened in the days of the Holocaust. For me, coming from South Africa and going, I mean, and looking at the checkpoints and the arrogance of those young soldiers, probably scared, maybe covering up their apprehension. There's no way in which I couldn't say. Of course, that is the truth. It reminds me of the kind of experiences that we underwent.
So that was Archbishop Desmond Tutu. Francis Boyle, talk about the significance of it being South Africa and what it means for one state to bring a charge against another state. Who are signatories here? And how binding is this? Explain what happened, for example, in Bosnia.
Sure. Well, first, the connection there with the late great Archbishop Tutu. The current lead counsel now in the lawsuit for South Africa is Professor John Dugard, a longtime friend of mine. Professor Dugard was one of the very few courageous white professors of international law who internationally opposed the criminal apartheid system in South Africa at risk to his life. Second, later on, Professor Dugard became UN Special Rapporteur for Palestine. I read all of his reports. They are excellent. Professor Dugard's heart and head are in the right place with the Palestinians, and he is one of the top professors of international law in the world. So there is a direct comparison between the Israeli apartheid system on all the Palestinians, including Palestinian citizens of Israel, and what happened in apartheid South Africa. Indeed, Professor Dugard has written that the Israeli system of apartheid against the Palestinians is worse than the apartheid that the Afrikaners applied to the black people in South Africa. I was involved in the struggle against apartheid in South Africa, and that is my assessment, too. Indeed, the parallels here then led me in November 2000 to call for the establishment, in a speech, the establishment of the divestment, disinvestment campaign against Israel for the exact same reasons we had a divestment, disinvestment campaign against the criminal apartheid regime in South Africa. And then in 2005, Palestinian civil society contacted me to go in with them on establishing the Palestinian boycott, divestment, and sanctions campaign against Israel, against apartheid Israel, for the exact same reason we had a BDS campaign against the criminal apartheid regime in South Africa. So Tutu, Dugard, I, and I would Ramaphosa, the foreign minister in South Africa, who's made very compelling speeches, they all understand what's going on here and what's at stake.
The issue of genocide in Bosnia, if you could explain for people who are not familiar with what happened, and then what came of the charges at the International Court of Justice.
Yes, well, Yugoslavia exterminated about 200,000 Bosnians, raped about 40,000 Bosnian women. I was the lawyer for all of them, arguing their case at the International Court of Justice, and I won these two orders on 8 April 1993 and 13 September 1993. Until I won that order, 8 April 1993, everyone was denying that genocide was going on. And once I won that order, that was massive and overwhelming in favor of the Bosnians, no one could deny anymore that genocide was going on. As for the effectiveness, when I walked out of the World Court on April 1993 and won that order, I walked into the foyer there outside the Grand Courtroom. The whole world news media were there. And I said at the time, the World Court has just determined that genocide is going on in Bosnia and Herzegovina. Under Article 1, every state party to the Genocide Convention has an obligation to prevent genocide in Bosnia, and I hereby request direct military intervention by the United States and the NATO states to save the Bosnians from genocide. Later that day, the United States and NATO announced that they were instituting a no-fly zone, enforcing a no-fly zone over Bosnia. So these orders by the World Court can have consequences. And it will be up to us here in the United States to devise the strategy for consequences for the Biden administration, because we have to pressure the Biden administration to order Israel to stop the genocide. They will do what we Americans tell them to do. In Operation Cast Lead, that had been going on for a period of time under President Bush Jr., Obama people were coming into power. Obama was about to be inaugurated, and in order not to spoil Obama's inauguration, the United States government told Israel to stop Operation Cast Lead. So we have to understand, we here in the United States of America have the power to stop this, but we have to figure out how to use the order that South Africa will win here in the United States of America. This is exactly what happened in Nicaragua. You remember, Amy, I was involved in advising almost every peace NGO and lawyer here in the United States on the legal issues with respect to Reagan's war against Nicaragua, El Salvador, Guatemala. My teacher, mentor, and friend, the late, great Abe Jays at Harvard Law School, won a world court order against the Reagan administration in 1984, and then also a final judgment on the merits in 1986. We here in the United States used that world court order and the final judgment to stop Reagan's war against Nicaragua. Regretfully,
we have 20 seconds.
Regretfully, 16,000 Nicaraguans were killed, including U.S. citizen Ben Linder. But we did stop that. And I believe that with this world court order that South Africa will win, we can stop what Israel is doing to the Palestinians.
Francis Boyle, professor of international law at the University of Illinois College of Law. His books include The Bosnian People Charge Genocide, Palestine, Palestinians, and International Law, as well as World Politics, Human Rights, and International Law. When we come back, as this pivotal election year gets underway, we speak with Ryan Grimm about how the powerful lobby group AIPAC is set to spend more than $100 million against progressive Congress members who are critical of Israeli human rights violations in Palestine. His new book, The Squad. Stay with us.
Al pueblo de México, a los pueblos y gobiernos del mundo. Hermano, nosotros nacimos de la noche, en ella vivimos, moriremos en ella. Pero la luz será mañana para los más, para todos aquellos que hoy lloran la noche, para quienes se niega el día, para todos la luz, para todos todo. Nuestra lucha es por hacernos escuchar y el mal gobierno grita soberbia y tapa con cañones sus oídos. Nuestra lucha es por un trabajo justo y digno y el mal gobierno compra y vende cuerpos y vergüenzas. Nuestra lucha es por la vida y el mal
gobierno. ELN para todas, todos, for everyone, everything, by Manu Chao. This week marks the 30th anniversary of the Zapatista uprising in Chiapas. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. It's 2024. As we move into this election year, we look now at how the powerful lobby group, AIPAC, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, is set to spend more than $100 million against progressive Congress members critical of Israeli human rights violations in Palestine. The goal is to remove members of the squad from Congress this year, including Congress members Cori Bush, Ilhan Omar, Jamal Bowman, Summer Lee, and the only Palestinian-American member of Congress, Rashida Tlaib. This comes as a Data for Progress poll found 2/3 of U.S. voters support a ceasefire in Gaza, including 80% of Democrats. For more, we're joined by Ryan Grimm, D.C. bureau chief of The Intercept. His book is just out. It's titled The Squad, AOC and the Hope of a Political Revolution. Ryan, why don't you lay out your revelations in this book? And perhaps you can start with AOC and what happened when she was elected. I want to play for you a clip. You write in your book about how a representative of AIPAC approached Democratic Congressmember Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's team with an offer of $100,000 in July of 2018 to, quote, start the conversation about her views on Israel. This is the then-candidate Ocasio-Cortez being interviewed on PBS in 2018 before she was reportedly contacted by AIPAC.
You, in the campaign, made one tweet or made one statement that referred to a killing by Israeli soldiers of civilians in Gaza and called it a massacre, which became a little bit controversial. But I haven't seen anywhere. What is your position on Israel?
Well, I believe absolutely in Israel's right to exist. I am a proponent of a two-state solution. And for me, it's not this is not a referendum, I think, on the state of Israel. For me, the lens through which I saw this incident, as an activist, as an organizer, if 60 people were killed in Ferguson, Missouri, if 60 people were killed in the South Bronx, unarmed, 60 people were killed in Puerto Rico, I just looked at that incident more through through just as an incident. And to me, it would just be completely unacceptable if that happened on our shores.
So that was Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez in 2018, before she was first elected and one of the four members of what's known as the Squad, which is also the title of your book, Ryan Grimm. Can you take it from there, what you reveal in this book?
Yeah, so and later in that interview, the interviewer, Hoover, really starts to parse a lot of her words. You know, you said the word occupation. You know, you said the word Palestine. What do you mean by this? And you can see her growing even more kind of visibly kind of uncomfortable about where the conversation is heading. And she finally just taps out at the end and says, look, I'm not a geopolitical expert on this issue. This wasn't something that we talked about at my dinner table, you know, in among Puerto Rican families in the Bronx. And she just moves on from there and actually stops doing interviews for a little while after that, after she'd been kind of from the time of her win in June until then, just kind of dominating and getting, you know, bigger and bigger interview requests, you know, eventually even doing like late night shows. So then, like you said, a week later, her team gets a call from somebody who says they're with AIPAC and that they saw the interview and that they're willing to help, you know, educate her on the issue, start the conversation. And to start that conversation, they've already gotten commitments of, you know, up to $100,000 and there would be a lot more money where that came from. Now, she didn't even consider the offer. She had plenty of campaign cash coming in. It wasn't even about the campaign cash, but it did open a window for her team and for her about what Congress is like for so many rank and file members of Congress who didn't have her profile at that point. Because now not only are you being offered $100,000 just to start, and there's a lot more where that came from, it comes with an implicit threat. And I think that's what you want to get into later. If you don't take the money, that money will still be spent, but it will be spent against you instead.
And Ryan, could you talk about, and you do so in the book, AIPAC's role in purging the Democratic Party of any potential candidates or office holders who don't toe the line when it comes to Israel?
So the same month that the Squad was sworn into office, that included Ilhan Omar and Rashida Tlaib, is January 2019. The super PAC Democratic Majority for Israel was stood up with this splashy New York Times profile. It was affiliated with AIPAC. It was founded by Mark Melman, who is an AIPAC advisor who had led AIPAC's effort to undo Barack Obama's Iran deal. He's also, or he was at the time, a consultant to Yair Lapid, who, as you know, is the head of the Yesh Atid party. Eventually, he actually became, while he was Melman's client, prime minister of Israel. So he's wearing multiple hats. So he founds this super PAC, DMFI, which then kind of does AIPAC's work in the 2020 and 2020, in the 2020 cycle. And they're built basically explicitly to stop the expansion of this faction within the Democratic Party that feels willing to criticize Israel. In May 2021, the last time there was a major war on Gaza, the Squad and a number of other House Democrats, you know, went to the House floor denouncing Israel's attack on Gaza. And that was sort of an alarm bell for AIPAC. And so AIPAC itself then after that launched its own super PAC after DMFI had spent, you know, millions itself. And in that cycle, the 2021-22 cycle, spent more than $30 million. Now they're looking to spend, you know, significantly more this cycle.
And you also say that the rise of the Squad and the rise of the counter-revolutionary forces has been simultaneous. Could you elaborate on that? Because obviously Donald Trump never tires of criticizing the squad as if they are in charge of the Democratic Party.
Yeah, it was really remarkable to go back and kind of re-report this story, the arc of kind of the starting with, the Bernie Sanders campaign in 2015-16 up through today, to see just how central this question of Israel-Palestine has been, you know, to the kind of pushback and the reaction to the rise of the squad the entire time. You know, the Democrats in 2018, if you remember, they ran against Trump, they ran against his wall, his xenophobia, his Muslim ban. And much of the first 6 months of the Democratic majority in 2019 was spent with Democrats, sometimes joined by Trump, sometimes not, coming after Ilhan Omar or Rashida Tlaib, you know, for various transgressions in tweets or speeches or otherwise. And it really kind of dictated and determined what the entire kind of progressive wing was doing. And so oftentimes you'll have the organization Justice Democrats or members of the squad say, you know, why are you spending so much time focusing on Israel-Palestine? And the answer would be, they're not. It's actually the reaction. They're kind of forced to. And so that the amount of spending that was done against them and that continues to be done against them kind of forged them into a cohesive political formation that might not actually have existed otherwise. But so in the 2022 cycle, like you said, you know, that's when they spent, you know, millions against not just Nina Turner, the most high profile example that they kept out of Congress, but also across the country going after progressives who were critical of Israel, but also were progressive because, you know, the same kind of hedge fund, private equity executives, you know, baseball team owners that are funding AIPAC and DMFI also have the same kind of interests as the as any, you know, major business owner would. So the same agenda that is, you know, that is that forms kind of the squad's criticism of Israel also, you know, their support of Green New Deal, Medicare for all, you know, higher, you know, closing, you know, tax loopholes for the wealthy. So it's kind of a bonus that you kind of align your class interests with this fight against, you know, Palestinian rights.
So if you can talk more, Ryan Grimm, about this election year, about the $100 million, who's involved with that, about the targeting of the squad plus, you know, more people who are allied with the squad have been elected since then, and also the role of Mark Penn and Burson Marsteller.
Right. So 2022 was the first time in its history that AIPAC did its own super PAC. Previously, it had, you know, given directly to campaigns, or its members had given directly to campaigns, and DMFI had done a super PAC kind of affiliated with AIPAC, but not straight from them. 2022 was the first time they did that, and they came through, like I said, more than $30 million. In some races, you know, spending more than $5 million. They spent millions against Summer Lee in the Pittsburgh race in the last, you know, month of the campaign. But there was enough kind of pushback from an organized group of progressive super PACs and also small donors that she was able to just barely hang on. And so in 2022, they really tried to kind of constrain the growth of the squad and squad aligned factions within the party. This cycle, they're really trying to shrink them. Like you said, there's been reporting that, you know, there have been offers of, you know, $20 million to two different candidates to try to run against Rashida Tlaib. They've successfully recruited candidates to run against Jamal Bowman. Cori Bush has a challenge. Ilhan Omar has a challenge. So now they're coming kind of directly at them. Now, Mark Penn and Nancy Jacobson are also kind of main characters in this book as well, along with Mark Penn's protege, Josh Gottheimer, who's a congressman from North Jersey, who's sort of like the chief antagonist of the squad. And they have raised, you know, tens of millions of dollars over the years for this organization. No labels, also from hedge fund executives, you know, private equity folks, you know, football team owners, that, you know, Home Depot CEOs, that kind of crowd. They try to present themselves as this kind of non-aligned centrist organization. Nancy Jacobson has said, you know, AIPAC is one of her, in one of the organizations that she works most closely with. And of course, famously now, they're trying to recruit a Joe Manchin type figure to run as a quote unquote kind of independent in the presidential campaign, which presumably would be to the benefit of Trump.
You mentioned Josh Gottheimer, the congressman from New Jersey. Could you talk about his history before he got into Congress?
Yeah. It is an interesting history because not only does it have this kind of standard kind of pro-Israel activism, but he worked with Mark Penn for many years, and Mark Penn did a lot of his business with Saudi Arabia, and that gets to kind of a creation of a political alliance in Washington that didn't get a lot of publicity over the years, which is kind of the teaming up of the United Arab Emirates, Saudi Arabia, and Israel. Those two countries still don't even recognize Israel, but in Washington, the three of them were spending enormously, basically to counter Iran and to counter Iran, and also of course to push back on kind of any climate agenda that might get in the way of where their fossil fuel interests lay, and that often meant targeting kind of the left flank of the Democratic Party. And so Josh Gottheimer kind of became the kind of lead antagonist against particularly Rashida Tlaib and Ilhan Omar, just repeatedly pushing for, censure resolutions, going on, cable news regularly to denounce his colleagues and encouraging other Democrats to then also denounce them. Teaming up with Hakeem Jeffries to do a kind of a super PAC that was aimed at kind of going after them and going after kind of squad aligned candidates as well. So that's really the kind of nexus of this civil war that's going on inside the House Democrats.
We have about 2 minutes to go, Ryan, and I'm wondering if you can talk about what most shocked you in the research for your book, The Squad.
I think it was the sheer amount of money that was involved and just how dominant it been, because we can say the numbers over and over again, $30 million, $40 million, $100 million. But what doesn't quite come through is how that influences not just the races where money is spent, but also where it's not spent. And so I heard of so many different conversations that would be held among consultants and campaigns that were worried that AIPAC or DMFI was going to start spending millions of dollars in their race. And they would meet, they'd have a conference call, and they'd figure out, okay, how do we stave this off? And so this is without AIPAC even spending a dime. And they would say, well, let's, the easiest thing we can do is let's just post I Stand With Israel. And some candidates would just do that. And then others would reach out to DMFI. John Fetterman, his campaign did this. Others did it as well. And say, what do we need to do? Like, what kind of policy positions do we need to publicly have so that you're going to stay out of this race? Not that you're going to fund us, but that you're not going to fund our opponents. And that really, to a shocking degree, constrained, what Democratic candidates were willing to say when it came to criticizing Israel.
Ryan Grimm, we want to thank you so much for being with us, D.C. Bureau Chief for The Intercept. Ryan's new book is called The Squad, AOC and the Hope of a Political Revolution. And we'll also link to your articles at The Intercept as you continue to cover this issue. For those who didn't get to see Democracy Now! On January 1st, you can go to democracynow.org and see the Belmarsh Tribunal excerpts of it, looking at the case of Julian Assange, whose final appeal goes before a London court on February 20th and 21st. Democracy Now! Produced with Renee Fels, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Terracena. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for the first edition of Democracy Now!
On the next Alternative Radio, hear Chalmers Johnson on Blowback, the Consequences of U.S. Foreign Policy. That's Alternative Radio, Wednesday afternoons at 4, right here on CJSF 90.1 FM, Burnaby.
Yeah. You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, and we wish you the best for the new year. You're